All right, so they didn't really give me a topic for tonight, and so I had to come up with one on my own. And so I don't know how interesting it's going to be for you, but I thought about being a Catholic in modern society would be sort of, it's kind of broad, but we'll try to narrow it down a little bit as we go along. And so first of all, we can say what sort of defines modern society, or people even say today post-modern society. And sometimes historians mark the changing of eras or time periods by great technological advances. For instance, some will say that the Middle Ages began with an agricultural breakthrough, which really began in the monasteries and with the improvement of breeding stock, horses, cows, pigs, and sheep, all that was greatly improved. And they also invented some better plows and crop rotation. This all allowed for much more efficient agriculture, surplus production of food, which then allowed for the development of cities. And so a lot of people say that's what really began the Middle Ages. Others say that marked time periods by political or military changes, advances, wars. Some would say that the Middle Ages began with the rise of Charlemagne and his crowning as Holy Roman Emperor. And so some mark the beginning of modern society with the fall of Constantinople in 1453. When that happened, that kind of marked the end of the Crusades, because the whole Crusades had been done to support the Eastern Christian Empire, the Byzantine Empire. Now that it was completely collapsed, there was no more need to help them. And Europe began to focus more on itself. Others would mark the beginning of modern society with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, which basically ended the religious wars in Europe and said that Protestantism was going to be there. And Protestants would say that they finally got themselves loose from Catholic oppression. But I believe the most profound moments that really marked the beginning of modern society happened two things simultaneously, two revolutions, one in the American colonies and one in France. By 1790, they had both run their course, and even though they were very different in their causes, very different in the course in which they were conducted, and had very different objectives, some of the results were the same. And one result that was very much the same was the marginalization or attempt to annihilate religion. Here in the colonies that became the United States, religion was marginalized. It was the first country without an official religion, without the government saying, we will support this religion and put our effort into it. And in France, it was the first modern or first state since the birth of Christ, or since the Edict of Milan, that came out and said, we will stomp out any religion that proposes anything transcendental. And these two things have stayed with us ever since that time. They're present in every government in the world today, and they appear in different ways, in different forms. And these ideas permeate even us. Oftentimes, when we're voting, when we're considering candidates, when we're thinking about things, we think nothing could be worse than a government seeking to impose the ethics of religion, especially Christianity. Even us who proclaim to be profound Christians fall into that trap that I can't vote for this person because they're too Christian. Or it's okay that this person does radically unchristian things because they do one thing that is Christian. Therefore, I can vote for them. And so we don't fully bring our deepest convictions into society. We allow society to tell us what we should do instead of us trying to set the example for society. or we think that there's nothing better than a government that persecutes openly any belief in the transcendental. These are ideas that they're very general and they're very vague, but they're actually pushed in the school system at a very early age. And so we find it very easy to justify bad choices sometimes, because there's a deep thought way back from when we were pretty young that says, oh, religion shouldn't be involved in government. Religion shouldn't be involved in politics. That person is too religious. That person is too ethical. Or that person does 10 things wrong but one right, therefore it's okay. And so we have to sort of be critical of our own thought process. And what is the deepest and truest criteria of my thought process and decision making? Is it truly my faith and the criteria of Christ and the Gospels? Or is it what other people will say, what other people will think, what is sort of the mode of society, what have I always done, what has my family always done? You know, it was really sad in 2010. I had to confront a bishop who was taking a pro-abortion stance. And he was doing it because being a Democrat and in the Democrat Party was more important to him than being true to the faith. Because his family had always been Democrat, and Catholics always vote Democrat, and therefore we have to support Democratic politicians no matter what. Even if it means, as he as a bishop, suspends all pro-life activities in a diocese for 3 months before an election. And we have to sort of be critical of ourselves. Do I have that thought pattern going on within me? And so then we, like I said, we hear this word postmodern society. And I would argue that is actually the nihilism resulting from the lack of the transcendental. And St. John Paul II calls it simply the culture of death. And we'll catch up on that here in just a moment. Some say that postmodernism began with the dropping of the atomic bomb. I say that postmodernism actually began much further back, way back. Beginning of the 14th century, with a man named William of Ockham, who had a philosophical idea called nominalism. And in nominalism, he refused to accept the idea of universals. So he would say, yes, I believe that there are humans, but there is no humanity. That's a false construct. And so then basically what that does is that removes all universal ideas and laws. So nothing is always wrong. Nothing is always true, because there are no universals. And so basically nominalism is the grandmother of relativism. And if you remember Pope Benedict XVI, when he started his pontificate, in his very first talk from the balcony of St. Peter's, he said, we need to free ourselves from the tyranny of relativism. And so that's where I sort of see things beginning with William of Ockham. And so nominalism is not only the denial of universals and the relation to particulars, but it's also the denial of abstract concepts. So it's also the ancestor to what we call positivism, which says there are no transcendentals. You can see there the roots of our governing system, that there are no transcendentals, or we call it naturalism, only what is nature around me do I accept. Or materialism, if I can't sense it with my five external senses, if it doesn't have weight and take up space, for me it doesn't exist. And so these are all very strong currents in thought today as well. And they're infantile. I mean, which one of us would deny the existence of a memory? We all have memories, but they don't have weight and take up space. I can't see them. I can vocalize them, but it's a vocalization of the memory. It's not the memory itself. I can't smell them. I can't touch them. And so you have to be very deranged with sort of a very strong evil agenda, or just very imbecile to propose one of those theories. But yet that is what reigns in our highest institutes of research. And that's why we can clone, and we can kill babies to do stem cell research, and all of those things. And so, the ushering in, when the postmodern society, so we have sort of its infancy, that first spark back with William of Ockham, but we see it sort of coming to the fore and starting to have a huge influence on the way the world is run with World War I. World War I, when you look at the war, you know, we have all kinds of things that we're taught and about history and about why it happened and how it happened and so on and so forth. But the results of the war were this. In 1914, there were still three major world powers that were confessional governments that supported Christian religion. The Kaiser of Germany was Protestant, and the whole German state supported the Protestant church. All the schools taught religion, all the universities taught religion, and only the students with the highest grades and the highest levels on intellectual tests were allowed to be ministers in that religion. The Austrian emperor was Catholic, and Austria-Hungary was a confessional Catholic state. All the schools were Catholic. All the universities were Catholic. And the government there supported the Catholic religion, and the emperor claimed himself the defender of the Pope. The Tsar of Russia was Orthodox. Every school in Russia was Orthodox. Every university in Russia taught the Orthodox faith. And it was a professed Orthodox Christian country. France, where the French Revolution had taken place, and the Catholic Church had been under severe persecution there since 1903, even the Carthusian monks were driven out of the Chartreuse by the atheist, militantly atheist government of France. England, which had now become sort of a-religious, even though the king still said they were Anglican and so on, they were Masons. And of course, the United States, which we have no religion. These three countries defeated the three religious powers. That was the result of World War I. The end of any world power that professed Christianity. And so with that, we see the ushering in of the postmodern age. The ushering in of the complete marginalization of religion and transcendental thought. And so, how has the church reacted to these things? Is the church just sort of a bystander sitting on the sidelines saying, oh, woe to us, look what's happening, oh my, oh my, oh my? Or were the Pope saying things and teaching things? Well, that's the big problem. Even though we're Catholics, we don't know. What did they teach about these things? What are they teaching us now about these things? And so the first one to have to confront this was Pope Pius IX. We don't hear too much about him, but I think he was probably one of the greatest popes in the history of the church. He has the longest pontificate. He reigned for 36 years. And when he became Pope, right at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the church was in a worse shape than it is right now, at least physically. Spiritually, I think the people were very strong. They'd just gone through a lot of suffering. They realized that they made it through that suffering by the grace of God, and I think their faith was strengthened. But their churches were destroyed, their schools were destroyed, their Catholic universities were destroyed, their professors had been killed. So many religious orders were just barely hanging on. So many of their houses had been taken away by different states, by different governments, their members sent out or martyred or whatever. And so it was a horrible time. But by the end of his pontificate, we had begun a golden age like we've never known in the church before. And so he sort of set the reaction of the church in motion. His successor, Pope Leo XIII, began the intellectual progress of this replacement of the church in the midst of this new pagan society. And he wrote an encyclical called Rerum Novarum, The Strange New Things. And when we hear about Rerum Novarum, they always talk about the social justice aspects. And there are many of them in there that are very important. But there are also many things in there about how we, as lay Catholics, need to defend the faith, propagate the faith, and support the faith in our everyday actions. And so a very important encyclical. And so the principles that Pope Leo XIII brings out in Rerum Novarum had actually been developed in the Middle Ages. The church working in society in the Middle Ages first developed four principles that always need to be upheld. That is the dignity of the human person, the pursuit of the true common good, even long term, solidarity, and subsidiarity. And then in actual action, that came out to be the right of sanctuary, that the church took upon herself the right to harbor anyone within her walls to protect them from the overreach of civil authorities. The protection and the cultivation of art guilds and trade guilds, they are the forerunners of our labor unions today. The relentless war against usury. There weren't banks at that time. There were just rich criminals who loaned money to people in desperate situations at horrendous interest rates. And so the relentless war against usury. Numberless benevolent institutions. Where were the first orphanages built? The first hospitals? The first institutions for the care of the poor and the elderly. Saudi Arabia, Iran, India, China, no, Catholic Europe. The dignity of every human person. The protection for those who had to labor for their sustenance, and a special provision made for the unemployed. These were all things that developed through the working of the church in society in the Middle Ages that now Pope Leo XIII sort of reconfigures for the modern world in Rerum Novarum. But when we go back and we think about the thought processes that are going on, we think about relativism, nihilism. Nihilism is the idea that everything is going to end up as nothing. Therefore, why try to make it any better? Everything is destined for failure. Everything is destined to end up in a pile of dust. Just go with the flow. It's your best bet. How many people live that way in our world today? Of course, relativism, I hope everyone knows what I'm talking about, but that is the predominant philosophy in all of our educational institutions, even most Catholic colleges and universities, sadly enough. And what that says is, I have my truth, and you have yours. What's good for me is good for me. It may not be good for you, but live and let live. We'll just have to agree to disagree. Oh, that's so profound. Because basically it says, all thought is useless. All consideration of any principle higher than myself that's worth striving for is aimless. And therefore, just allow yourself to be led around like you have a ring in your nose by somebody else. And that's where most of our college students are. I mean, it almost nauseated me when about 3 weeks ago, maybe, I had a few meetings at the parish and I finished up and I went into my living room and I hadn't seen the news all day. And I flipped on the news and there they had this demonstration in Chicago that stopped a Trump rally. And the reporters were out there interviewing the demonstrators, asking them why they were there. And of about the 12 they interviewed, only one could come up with an answer. Now, I'm not saying that there was really nothing there to demonstrate against, but the point that I'm making, and the point that they made, really, there before God, the television, and the whole world, is that they were just out there following the ideas of somebody they didn't know who, didn't have one thought in their own head about what they were doing, and were just there causing a problem. And yet they're university students. They're our best and our brightest for the future. Is it any wonder our country is in the situation it's in? And now I could go on for 2 hours and talk about how did the situation in the universities get to the way it is and where did all that come from and why is it there? But we don't have that much time. All right? The point I'm just trying to make is that there's a huge problem. All right? And it goes to thought. It goes to bad thought. All right? So, we have this relativism and this nihilism, and I talked a little bit about what some of the popes are doing, but what's God doing? Is he just sitting on the sidelines letting all this happen? Well, interestingly enough, 1789, the French Revolution begins. 1776, our own began. And all of a sudden, in the early 1900s, Mary starts to appear. And the last apparition of Mary before that was Guadalupe in Mexico in 1531. So it's like a 300-year hiatus, and all of a sudden, here comes Mary again. And where does she appear? The first two times, France, the belly of the beast. Robespierre and all that went on, where so many Catholics and priests and religious sisters and brothers and so on went under the guillotine. And there, Our Lady appeared at La Salette, and then at Lourdes. And then there was a great problem in Ireland. The Catholic population was being starved out to our benefit. Most of them came here. But Our Lady appeared there at Knock. Then, as that horrible war was coming to an end, and the last great bastions of the Christian faith were being brought down, Our Lady appeared at Fatima in Portugal. In the 1920s and 30s, she appeared two more times in Belgium, which will be the last modern Western European country to hold on to the faith. The last of sort of governmental Catholicism was stomped out there in the 1990s. And so Our Lady has been coming to our aid. Do we know what she said in these apparitions? Do we have any idea? And are we heeding what she's asked to get the benefits that she's promised? Are our bishops, our priests, encouraging people to do so? And then we look at our own country. American Catholicism and the postmodern society. Catholics are now over 30% of the population. I mean, officially it's like 24%, but I think if you figure in all the undocumented Mexicans and so on, we'll probably get up over 30. Over 150 members of Congress profess to be Catholic. The majority of the justices on the Supreme Court profess to be Catholic. 7 of the 21 candidates from the two major parties who began to run for president last year professed to be Catholic. Yet seeing the trends of our society and the laws of our land, any outsider coming from the outside to the United States that knew what the true teachings of the church were would think that if there were any Catholics at all in the United States, they must be a helpless, pitiful minority under heavy persecution. But we're actually a helpless, pitiful, large majority, because we actually are the largest religion in the country, under terrible persecution, because we refuse to defend ourselves. We refuse to put forth the truth of our faith. We refuse to live our faith in the public square. And so there's a great book written by Archbishop Chaput of Philadelphia. He was actually the Archbishop of Denver when he wrote the book back in 2008. And in one place he says, "We can start by admitting that the cultural and political assumptions of the Catholic Church in the USA over the last 40 years have largely failed. These failures have weakened the spiritual identity of many Catholics. They have also rendered the American Catholic witness to the gospel partial and unsure. And they have left our nation without a credible alternative to the way of life that every day seems to grow more remote from the Christian ideal." And then he quotes Cardinal Avery Dulles in here as well. And that was a very nice quote that I'd like to read for you. Cardinal Dulles, the American Jesuit theologian and cardinal, wrote, "The greatest danger facing the church in our country today is that of an excessive and indiscreet accommodation." Instead of putting forth an example of truth that would lead to peace and harmony and justice in society, we accommodate to evil as it exists. Surveys routinely show that most Catholics in this country don't know their faith or simply don't accept it. You know, there's some other stats that he doesn't mention here that I happen to know. For instance, that in 1965, 78% of all Catholics in this country went to Mass every Sunday. In the year 2000, it was still 48%. Since 2000, in just 16 years, we're down to 28%. Why the big decline in these 16 years? The greatest generation is dying off. And who's behind them? No offense, folks, the Woodstock generation. And so that's one of the big problems. And as Archbishop Chaput points out, Catholics just don't know their faith, and you can't love what you don't know. And so they're very indifferent, at best indifferent to their faith. Some of them, because of the weakness of their faith when they get into the college university setting, are brought to hate their faith and to hate all that it represents and everyone who brought it to them, all their ancestors and all their heritage and all their tradition. Because Karl Marx and Lenin, they knew very well one thing. If you want to control people, you have to isolate them and make them feel helpless. If you can isolate them and make them feel helpless, you have total control over them. So how do we isolate and make people feel helpless? Destroy the family. Destroy all societal traditions. And take away personal property. Do those three things, and you can control anyone. And so if we were to boil down all the encyclicals written since the time of Pius IX until even now with Pope Francis, what's the three things that the popes are constantly trying to defend? The family, tradition, and property. And the man who sort of summarized that so well and wrote this beautiful little book that's very much worth your time to read is actually a professor from Brazil. And he was a professor in the 40s through the 60s in a very prominent Brazilian university. And he saw how the Communist Party was working on the youth and trying to take them away, very much like they're doing here in this country, from their tradition, from their faith, from their families. And so he began to give a series of talks to the people, to the students at the university, to counteract this communist movement. And he wrote this book, Revolution and Counter-Revolution, which summarizes what these revolutions, the Communist Revolution, the French Revolution, so on, what these revolutions meant, what their goals were, how they're still working through society. In the counter-revolution, how do we counteract that? And so the lay movement that then he formed, that followed his ideas, is called, guess what? Tradition, family, and property. And many of you don't know it by that name, but you've probably received emails and things in the mail from a group called America Needs Fatima. That's an outreach of tradition, family, and property. All right? So, two books definitely worth reading in this line. Then there was a great quote that Archbishop Chaput had from a priest who was a theologian back in the 40s who analyzed American culture as he saw it then in the Catholic Church in the United States in the 1940s. And he said this: "It is customary for some to take a rosy view of American Catholic life, basing their optimism on the tables of statistics concerning the growth of the Catholic population, the income and resources of the Church, the number of communions, etc. But such a method of computation is very unreliable where spiritual realities are concerned. Were it of any value, we could compute the degree of religious fervor from the quantities of grease burnt in votive stands. But our optimism would soar to the very skies. Even in the case of those who are wholly faithful to the external obligation of religion, there is often little evidence, aside from their devotions, that they are living Christian lives. Large areas of their lives are wholly unilluminated by their faith. Their ideas, their attitudes, their views, on current affairs, their pleasure in relaxations, recreation, their tastes in reading and entertainment, their love of luxury, comfort, and bodily ease, their devotion to success, their desire of money, their social snobbishness, racial consciousness, nationalistic narrowness and prejudice, their bourgeois complacency and contempt for the poor, and all of these things, they're indistinguishable from the huge, sickly mass of paganism that surrounds them. He wrote that in 1947. If it was true then, it's 100 times truer today. And so, Archbishop Shugan, let's say, a kind of foggy worldliness settled into the American Catholic soul. He says, American Catholics now face a crisis of faith, mission, and leadership. The task of fixing these things falls equally on lay Catholics and their bishops. Because no one can force you to deepen your faith. We can provide opportunities, and beautiful, you're all here taking a wonderful opportunity to do that. But then what's our mission? What's God calling us to as lay Catholics in this country at this time and this place? How are we supposed to bloom in this garden to make it more beautiful, where we've been planted? And who's leading us? Well, thanks be to God, we do have a leader. Bishop Marino is a real leader. So maybe we can get behind him, we can pull together, and we can truly start getting some things done. And so the Archbishop Chukwu goes on to say that this renewal must come from the inside out. That's in here. That's what St. Augustine said when he converted. He said, Lord, you were inside and I was outside. You were calling me in the depths of my conscience and I was distracted with the things of the world. And so that, it has to start on the inside. And then we see that Mary is the mother of Christ and the church. I already went through a list of apparitions, but I want to talk about the necessity of Fatima. What did Our Lady say there? She first of all showed the children hell. Now why would Mary scare these children almost to death, showing them hell? Maybe she knew that 50, 60 years in the future, there would be even bishops from pulpits like this saying that there was no hell. And then she told them to pray. She told them to pray the rosary every day. She told them to receive the sacraments frequently. She told them to add a little prayer on at the end of each decade of the rosary. And then she said, she made some prophetic statements. She said that World War I would end soon. That was 1917. It did. It ended the next year, within 6 months of her apparitions. She said that a new government would arise in Russia that would become the enemy of the church, that would kill millions of the faithful. We saw that as well. But that isn't over. The Soviet Union is gone, but all of the ideas of the Soviet Union, free abortion on demand, into the family, into personal property, destruction of all tradition, are alive and well in this country like never in the Soviet Union before. So Our Lady said that Russia would then spread her errors throughout the world. Well, we might have defeated the Soviet Union economically and militarily, but ideologically, they converted us. Or at least our whole university system. And then we pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to have our children indoctrinated there. Then another great book, I don't have a copy of it, but I would definitely recommend it. It's not extremely long, but it'll sort of give you an outlook and maybe some courage. Is a book written by Cardinal Ratzinger back in the mid-90s called Salt of the Earth. It was really an interview with Vittorio Masori, or Peter Seewald. And in the third part of that book, he starts talking about how he sees in the future that the church is going to be greatly reduced. He sees that this wave of materialism, atheism, nihilism, relativism hasn't run its full course yet. And that the church is going to be reduced to small pockets of people who live the faith very intensely. And then once the nihilists have kind of annihilized themselves, those will be places of growth that will grow back out again. Now, our idea of Christian charity would say we shouldn't allow them to annihilate themselves completely. We should try to help them. And that's what we're talking about in the Year of Mercy. Two of the spiritual works of mercy are instruct the ignorant and counsel the doubtful. About 95% of the people who call themselves Catholic are extremely ignorant in their faith. Are we willing to instruct them in this Year of Mercy? Often our children, our grandchildren, have doubts about their faith. Are we willing to counsel them in those doubts? Or, well, they don't really like to talk about religion and I don't want to be uncomfortable, and so I'll just take the easy way out and not do it. And so we have to think about the true Catholic participation in the political process. I'd already told you the four principles of Catholic social teaching: the dignity of the human person, pursuit of the common good, solidarity, and subsidiarity. The last two, what do they mean? Solidarity is the right to gather, to form associations and groups to pursue a good goal that's good for all of society. And then subsidiarity is the principle that all things should be handled on the lowest level of government possible. So if the local government can run education, they should. If it takes a state government to take care of the highways, then it should. If it takes a federal government to defend borders and provide for an army, then it should. But the federal government doesn't have to run the schools. A local government can do that. And that's the principle of subsidiarity, that things should be handled on the lowest level of government possible. And then I read off those things that were developed during the Middle Ages. I talked about Rerum Novarum. And then in 1991, on the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, St. John Paul II wrote a sequel. He called it Centesimus Annus, 100 years later. And I bet you could all repeat with me what the three main themes of Centesimus Annus were: tradition, family, and property. So, I also want to point out something that Pius XI did. By the time he was Pope in the 1920s and 30s, communism was on the march. Some of the greatest Catholic states were under siege, Mexico and Spain. And he wrote an encyclical called Quas Primus, that which should be first. And in there, at the end of that, he proclaimed the feast day of Christ the King. I would recommend reading that encyclical. And why Christ should be the king of our hearts, the king of our minds, and the goal of our action.